and welcome to the Yatrapixie Podcast. This particular one is going to focus on ethics in surgery. I would like to pause for a moment to state my sources. The majority of my research has come from The Ethics of Surgical Practice, Cases, Dilemmas, and Resolutions by James W. Jones, Lawrence B. McCullough, and Bruce W. Richmond. For my other sources, I have hearkened back to my days as a philosophy student, and also, for a couple of case studies that I'd forgotten, I used Wikipedia. Shame on me. As Voltaire once said, "Sir, if you are going to argue with me, please define your terms, and we shall do just that." Ethics is the disciplined study of morality, and morality is a set of customary behaviors governing how we act, as well as expectations of character that are regarded as proper for a particular culture at a particular time. Ethics itself can be subdivided into two groups. There is theoretical ethics, which is the exploration of what is right, what we should do, and statements of what we should do are called normative statements or normative claims. And then there is also applied ethics, which is, in a specific situation or case study, what is the best course of action. Today I plan to talk more about theoretical ethics and build a toolkit of what we can use to think about ethical questions. There's this idea that in ethics there are no right answers, and I'm going to tell you right now that that is not actually true. When we talk about ethics, there are well-reasoned arguments, and there are poorly reasoned arguments. And what we need to be able to do is differentiate between the two of them. We need to have terms to talk about morality, and we need to see how these terms and ideas work in ethics itself. Let us move on to our last general definition, which is surgical ethics. Surgical ethics, which comes as a surprise to no one, is the application of ethics to specific problems in surgical practice. It is a subset of medical ethics. All surgeons are doctors, but not all doctors are surgeons. For those who have always hated discussions of ethics in the past, I say to you that it is vital to have a good set of tools for thinking about ethical questions, so that when true ethical situations come up, as they will in surgical practice, you are able to respond to them in a meaningful, useful, ethical way. Let us move on to the ethical toolkit itself. Since surgical ethics is a subset of medical ethics, it will surprise no one that the famous Beauchamp and Childress four principles of biomedical ethics still apply to surgery. These four principles, in order of most powerful in argumentation to least powerful, are autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. The principle of autonomy recognizes the rights of individuals to self-determination. That is, individuals are allowed to make their own informed decisions about personal matters. This includes courses of treatment. In other words, patients get the last word about what will happen to them when they fall under our care. Beneficence refers to the normative claim that we should do good to other people. It is the intent for all actions of a healthcare provider to create wellness in our patients. The principle of non-maleficence is summed up by the Latin phrase primum non nocere, which means first do no harm. The final principle of justice is concerned with the distribution of healthcare resources, which are finite. This is wrapped up in the concepts of fairness and equality, that is, who gets what treatment, and why do they deserve it, or don't. These four principles of biomedical ethics are the ones that we see butting heads in any given ethical problem. Moving on to another term, I would like to discuss the concept of the fiduciary. The word fiduciary comes from the Latin fidera, which means to trust. The fiduciary relationship refers to the fact that patients trust us, and also that we are responsible for them and their trust. The concept of the physician as a fiduciary of the patient was developed only in the 18th century by John Gregory and Thomas Percival. It's a new idea. Contrary to popular belief and custom, modern medical ethics does not directly descend from Hippocrates. In fact, the swearing of our Hippocratic oath is a modern tradition which was made to assert a link to Hippocrates in modern medicine that does not, in fact, exist. There are four values that a proper fiduciary needs to have. The first one is integrity. Integrity does not just mean that we can trust what you say and expect you to abide by what you say. Integrity also means, in this case, having intellectual excellence despite all the distracting factors that come with being a surgeon. This includes keeping up with medical information. This also includes self-care, so that a physician is functioning at his or her best when in clinic or the OR. And I might put forward that intellectual excellence also requires a continued interest and desire to learn more within one's own field. The second quality required for a good fiduciary relationship is that a physician should be compassionate. This means that the physician is alert and responsive to pain, misery, and anxiety of the patient. The third quality is that of self-effacement, which means that personal preconceptions and preferences must be discarded in order to be a good surgeon. This may be in direct opposition to a natural ego that can evolve from mastering remarkable abilities. Finally is the quality of self-sacrifice, or as Dupuytren was famously quoted saying, "One must be the best among surgeons, but the least among men." And as a final point of the fiduciary relationship, there is a power imbalance in the doctor-patient relationship, because surgeons will typically get paid for their activities in some way, but the patient may or may not get better. Now I'd like to mention the doctor double effect, which is the idea that sometimes when an action is done towards a good end, there is a serious harm done as a side effect. Double effect is not concerned with poor actions that are a means towards an end. Double effect only comes into play with poor results that are correlated or coincidental. Whenever a poor outcome occurs as the result of a well-intentioned action, the doctrine of double effect comes into play. This is not an excuse, but it does form an explanation towards the intentions of the doer. And now we have completed our toolkit and are ready to move on to case studies. I would like to begin with some theoretical famous cases before moving on to more realistic ones. I hope to show by this that ideas that have come about from thought experiments or from deductive reasoning do in fact work in real life. For the philosophers out there, you will be completely unsurprised by what happens next. Yes, I'm going to talk about trolleys. There's a famous runaway trolley case which comes to us from Philippa Foot in the 1960s. The basic trolley thought experiment goes like this. There is a runaway trolley that is on a track. The track later divides. On the track that the trolley is set to go down, there are five people tied to the railroad. On the track that it can be switched to, there is one person tied to the railroad. You are an observer standing at a lever that can switch the trolley from the five-person track to the single-person track. What do you do? There's actually quite a lot to be said about this particular experiment, but what I mainly wanted to show is the use of the doctrine of double effect here. If you pull the lever, you do end up killing one person, and the point that is usually made in the trolley experiment is that your action actively harms someone else, even though you do save five. Or, if you're utilitarian, you save a total of four. The thing about pulling the lever is that this is usually done to save the five, not to kill the one. And that is the important action. To a certain degree, you could argue that the one person dying is a side effect of saving the other five. Some might say that this single person is in fact a means towards saving the other five. But I tend to disagree and believe that it is, in fact, a side effect of a bad situation that you have no other choice in. Of course, it is also possible that we could not pull the lever and allow the five on the trolley to die, although this means that the one would survive. This absolves us of any activity in the particular scenario, but this doesn't mean that we are necessarily better off ethically. And I think that, as surgical people, we would prefer to act rather than not act. And speaking of acting rather than not, we can turn our minds towards actual case studies. In this scenario, a woman in labor requests that she have a therapeutic abortion, and for religious reasons, she is refused. In this scenario, both the mother and child die. But instead of getting hung up on our gut reactions to a case study, we should instead use our ethical toolkit to dissect the situation. In this scenario, the key elements that are acting against each other are those of autonomy, beneficence, and non-maleficence. The question of autonomy has to do with the fact that the patient has asked for a specific therapy. Given that this patient is competent, we have no reason to refuse her autonomy. And for the sake of this argument, we shall consider this patient competent. Therefore, by the rules of biomedical ethics, we behave unethically if we deny her her request. The second point is that of non-maleficence. In this case, the caregiver did not wish to harm the unborn child. And it is this attempt at non-maleficence that is most ethically dissonant, because it does not actually pertain to the patient herself. And the third point in play here is the desire to do well for this woman, to give her the best outcome that can be given in any situation. It was simply that the single request, the one that could have potentially saved her life, was refused. Continuing with the theme of autonomy being the greatest contender in biomedical ethics, I'm now going to talk about the most commonly cited surgical problem. A Jehovah's Witness patient who comes in for an elective surgery and then, in the middle of it, has some sort of catastrophe and needs a blood transfusion is almost cliché. However, there is still much to be learned from this case. In a situation where you have given full consent to an individual who understands the risks of a surgery, you must assume that that person understands the risks that you told of them during the consent. This is still true for people who hold views that you may consider foolish. Indeed, the idea that a Jehovah's Witness somehow does not understand the risk of surgery is false. Jehovah's Witnesses are, in general, well knowledgeable about what will happen to them should they go in for procedure, and they also appreciate deeply the sacrifice that they may make for the sake of their own beliefs. And we must not simply assume that because we do not necessarily agree with their beliefs, that the absurdity of this absolves them of autonomy. In the situation of a Jehovah's Witness who needs a blood transfusion to be saved, it is still not ethical to deliver blood product. Certainly, the concept of beneficence would be our motive for that. However, as a patient's fiduciary, we garner their trust and must be deserving of it. And being trustworthy means keeping promises and pacts that we make. And respecting autonomy in this case is a part of keeping that promise. We may not like refusing blood products for a person who is in therapeutic need of them, but for those of us in medicine and surgery, we must remember that we did not become doctors to make ourselves feel better. We became doctors to be fiduciaries for patients and to make them better. And now for a case study that I personally find to be a bit of a puzzler. Pretend now that you as a surgeon are carrying out a fairly routine operation, say a cholecystectomy, and in the process of this operation, you somehow discover that your patient has a malignant carcinoma of, I don't know, let's say the bowel. It is asymptomatic, extensive, and you've only just found out about it while your patient is anesthetized. The question here now is, what do you do? As doers, I suspect that surgeons would prefer to simply take out this diseased piece of bowel. It's already one operation, the risk of a second anesthetic is significant, and surely any person would want a disease cut out of them. But that is not necessarily the case. And this case illustrates again why people say that there are no right answers in ethics. The real point is that every scenario is entirely unique. If, for example, you knew this patient quite well and could reasonably guess that they would want the cancer removed, then it might be ethical for you to take it out. Certainly, it is a beneficent action. On the other hand, if you didn't know this patient, it might not be the best way to proceed. You cannot know in the middle of this surgery how malignant this cancer is. You can't tell if it's spread, you can't tell if this person will indeed be benefited at all by your action. For all that can be known at this moment, this person might die in a couple of months, or less, whether or not you take out this piece. And perhaps the more ethical action, then, would be to leave it for later discussion to find out what this person wants. Perhaps it would be more appropriate to work up this patient again and give them the right to choose what will happen in their course of therapy. Some people might prefer to not have a second surgery or to not have this bowel removed. This could be particularly true if removal of the diseased portion requires something like an ileostomy at the end of it. Some people might find such a procedure, especially if they were surprised upon awakening, quite disfiguring, and the morbidity from this would be, in fact, maleficent, while also stomping completely over their autonomy. At this point, I may have created more questions than I have answered. However, it was my intent mainly to demonstrate that ethics is important, that ethical decisions should be made based on sound reasoning, and I wish to propose a basic toolkit containing the concepts of autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, justice, the fiduciary, and the doctrine of double effect to aid in the analysis of ethical conundrums. Since I'm running out of time, I'm now going to quote Dr. Charles Dunlop, a professor of pathology at Tulane University. "The affection and respect you will command from this day forward as doctors of medicine, these are not the things of your own making. These things have been earned for you by the decency and humanity of generations of good men. These men are dead, and for the next few years you will hold in your own hands this magnificent heritage. Thank you, and good day."